are listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
My guest is Eliza Griswold. 2 months ago, the extremist group Boko Haram made international headlines when it kidnapped almost 300 Nigerian schoolgirls. The story was horrifying, but as Eliza Griswold points out, not particularly surprising. Boko Haram's terrorism of the Nigerian population and the international efforts to combat it started long before the group became a household name. Ms. Griswold's report on the U.S. military's approach to African extremist groups, can General Linder's Special Operations Forces stop the next terrorist threat, was the cover story of the June 15th New York Times Sunday magazine. And Eliza Griswold, an award-winning journalist, poet, translator, and author of The Tenth Parallel, joins us once again on the show. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
According to Reuters, the U.N. Security Council sanctioned Boubacar Chicao, the Boko Haram leader, yesterday. It's the first U.N. sanction on a Boko Haram individual since the group was blacklisted. How effective do you think it will be?
In truth, not very effective at all. His local reach is profound, and his international reach is not so profound.
He's not setting up Swiss bank accounts.
Not at all.
Boko Haram has been engaged in terrorist activities for over a decade. What's taken so long to even impose a sanction?
Well, that's a very good question. I mean, part of what's taken so long to impose the sanction is that these local roots and the local injustice that groups like Boko Haram spring out of are typically under-recognized by the international community.
The UN lists Boko Haram as an al-Qaeda affiliate. How closely are they connected to al-Qaeda or other Islamic groups?
Well, they've claimed allegiance to al-Qaeda several years ago. Really, that name means how dangerous are they? How dangerous are they willing to be? And Abu Bakr Chicao has declared the desire to wage jihad globally.
Although there is some conjecture that he may not even be alive, that somebody else has assumed that name.
That's absolutely true. And there isn't really, within Boko Haram, there are several factions.
Are they a threat outside of Africa?
I would say yes. And that is one thing that I learned profoundly while doing this article.
Because they do seem to have a really local aspect to them.
Well, the deal is that terrorism in general, and especially terrorism in Africa but elsewhere, grows not out of poverty. It grows out of injustice. And that kind of injustice has very local dimensions. But like other groups we've seen around the world, their desire is to – it's easier, actually, to wage a global jihad than a local one.
Boko Haram translates to Western education is sinful. That suggests that they also represent what's been called the clash of civilizations. What is their ultimate goal, to limit education to the study of the Quran?
We could say that their goal would be to establish an Islamic state in northern Nigeria, but really that gives them a lot of credit. They are disruptors. They grow out of a movement that has actually existed in northern Nigeria since independence, since the colonial era, of wanting to oppose colonialism, wanting to oppose the West with what is seen as traditional beliefs, and that traditional belief lies within Islam.
Nigeria is the world's 13th largest oil producer, but aren't those oil reserves diminishing?
They are diminishing, and they're also in the south.
So Boko Haram would have no claim to them.
Boko Haram would have absolutely no claim to them. Boko Haram has no claim to anything. And that is partly why, you know, the lack of education in northern Nigeria, there's no state-sponsored schooling at all. Even the girls in Chibok were paying for their schooling. So really, it's out of that lack of education that Boko Haram has its roots.
In your book, The Tenth Parallel, you pointed out that although more than half of the world's Muslims and even more of the world's Christians live near it, religious differences are not the only sources of conflict along that latitudinal line that runs through Nigeria, Eastern Africa, and Southeast Asia. Is Boko Haram's fight also ethnic? Is it tribal? Resource conflict?
Yeah. Boko Haram's fight is all of those things. And I think that's really important in debunking an oversimplified notion of a clash of civilizations, and especially in Nigeria, where we have a majority Muslim north and a majority Christian south. Boko Haram comes out of such disparate disparate elements, including climate change. Because one of the things that we've seen as the farms in northern Nigeria and North Africa become less viable, people are, and nomads and farmers who tend to be Muslim, are pushed south towards predominantly Christian areas. And this actually leads to violence that looks religious on the surface, but is linked actually to changing weather temperatures.
But you say that they make no claim on the oils. In a recent article in The Guardian, Nafiz Ahmed writes, Islamist militancy in Nigeria is being strengthened by Western and regional fossil fuel interests. He says the instability dates back to British colonial times, where Muslims were in the north, Christians and the animists in the south. And then, of course, came the Civil War, the Biafran War. There have been other little civil wars in Nigeria. I thought that democracy was supposed to bring secularism and a sense of national unity.
So, first of all, I would dispute that claim. I don't think that the rise of Islamism has anything to do with Nigeria's oil reserves, except that we do see religion as a perceived antidote to corruption. And oil wealth in Nigeria is so corrupt that for many years, between $4 and $8 billion a year were being embezzled by the Nigerian government.
Africa Review reported that in 2012, after a mass arrest of Boko Haram soldiers, the experts identified some foot soldiers and mercenaries as people displaced by severe drought in neighboring Niger. They were not religious fundamentalists and didn't even know basic verses of the Quran.
That's exactly right. What we're seeing, and this is one reason, and this is true in Syria as true as it is in northern Nigeria, people under the umbrella of Islam or under whatever umbrella, it's easy to take up thuggery and support oneself and live by rule of the gun and call it religion.
My guest is Eliza Griswold. Her article, Can General Linda's Special Operation Forces Stop the Next Terrorist Threat, was in the New York Times Magazine on the June 15th issue. How many American troops and special forces are stationed throughout Africa?
About 700.
So we're not talking about a lot. Are they engaging in combat?
You know, we're not talking about a lot. And when we look at numbers, it was 100 American special forces who overthrew the Taliban in Afghanistan. So these guys operate in small numbers. They're extremely flexible, and that is one of the values. Are they involved in combat? They're involved in direct action, which is the word we would use for, like, night raids.
Because the 275 or to 300 people who are being sent to Iraq, we're told, will not engage in any fighting.
Well, one of the things, yes, that's correct. They're different. They work under different mandates. And one of the things that makes it very difficult for the U.S. Special Operations Forces to work directly in Africa is the corruption and the problems with indigenous forces, with African forces. And the Leahy Amendment makes sure that we aren't able to work directly with those forces, in African troops or troops elsewhere in the world, who have been accused of human rights violations.
How does that work in Nigeria, where Nigerian troops have been accused of human rights violations?
It's seriously...
Uganda's another case.
Exactly. It seriously hamstrings who we are able to partner with. And I would say if there is any effort that the American public could get behind to make our approach to Africa more effective when it comes to the military, it is to work to support the transparency and cleaning up African forces themselves.
Many of the American soldiers have served in the Middle East. How does fighting militant groups in Iraq or Afghanistan compare to Nigeria or the Central African Republic?
Well, one, that's an excellent question, and that's one I found myself asking consistently. And it's not just how does the fighting compare, it's how does what you're doing compare. And, you know, one of the things, our perception, driven by Hollywood and obviously driven by wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, is these kind of night raids, these go-in, you know, killer capture missions, when in fact much of what special operations forces do is much sleepier, boring work of simply training African troops. And that's why when recently at West Point, President Obama announced that we're going to be this training and equipping this $5 billion effort in Africa, it wasn't so different from much of what our special operations forces already do.
Is the money being also spent on technological advancements in tracking the people like Boko Haram?
That money comes from different pots, but absolutely that is one thing we do with our intelligence. We are tracking Boko Haram.
Special forces are mapping towns, looking for vulnerable communities. What makes a Nigerian community a likely target for Boko Haram?
If injustice and not poverty is the primary driver of extremism, a town or a people who are disenfranchised, who have no links to the government, where a government could be rapacious and actually work against their interests, or when they don't see a possibility for buying into a modern world.
You're right. The most vulnerable communities aren't those of isolated mountain people, but those squeezed in the middle, caught between a traditional way of life and a failing contemporary landscape.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. Those are the people who are thinking, will not be herders. They will not have cattle. The cattle are dying. There's no land for them. What are they going to do? Those young people are most vulnerable to turning to extremism.
Your article focuses on Brigadier General James B. Linder. Where is he stationed?
He is stationed in Stuttgart in Germany, in AFRICOM.
In AFRICOM. So he is... He is the head of forces that are dealing with Africa, but he's in Germany.
He's in Germany.
Isn't that a rather long distance reach?
That's quite a long distance reach because there is no politically sustainable home in Africa for AFRICOM, and therein lies one of its fundamental problems.
Linder says that the future of war is about winning people, not territory. We've heard that kind of thing before. How does he work to strengthen communities against extremist threats?
He relies increasingly on people like a guy named Patrick, who is in the piece, a member of special operations who is an anthropologist, who goes first and does the kind of mapping of people and places that to identify what the attempt is. To allow people to identify primarily what they need, what communities need, as opposed to going in and building schools where schools are not even the primary interest.
The opposite of what the radical militant groups are doing to appeal to people.
Sometimes the opposite, sometimes in direct competition. Now, this is one of the lessons out of Afghanistan and Iraq, especially the schools, where we would go in and do what we thought was right without addressing actually what local people wanted. We, in fact, compounded the very problems we were seeking to combat. And so this effort, this is part of coming out of lessons learned out of Afghanistan and Iraq. But in places, we have Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb and other terrorist organizations actually supplying things like rice. They understand people's basic needs as well as we do.
And we're giving satellite phones to poor towns so that they can call for help if the extremists arrive?
We aren't. The group that's doing that is another group that's working in the fight against Joseph Kony in Central Africa and in northern Uganda. That's the Kony 2012 group.
How similar is the—well, Kony, of course, is a man who's declared himself some kind of an inheritor of he's kind of Jesus' son or something like that.
Kony is quite simply a nutbag. I mean, yeah, he claims nominally to be a Christian. He works with spirits still— To the latest reports of his still being alive, he was performing kind of exorcisms on his own people and inuring them to bullets with water.
So can we approach the Kony threat in the same way we approach the Boko Haram threat?
It's a totally different animal. It's also essential to understand the scope of it. We're dealing with maybe 200 to 250 straggling members of the Lord's Resistance Army in possibly Sudan, Central African Republic. It's a very different, and what the U.S. is doing and what the U.S. believes to be effective with really in support of the Ugandans is shouting from loudspeakers over the jungle, come home, the fight is over, come out of the bush, really getting people to defect.
It's a complicated situation because the United States is also talking about sanctions on Uganda because of recent laws that that call for the death penalty for homosexuals. So we are defending the government on the one hand and criticizing it on another.
That is absolutely essential to understand. And the scope of what's going on in Uganda and the increasing abuse of power Museveni is undertaking is essential to look at.
What about Nigeria, where the government has been incredibly corrupt. People were arrested for protesting against the government's inaction against Boko Haram.
Corruption is the central problem in Nigeria that actually leads to the rise of Boko Haram and other groups like it. Because, again, this idea of injustice, if I can prove that the government is unjust, well, then I can make my case for my rival organization. And that is where groups like Boko Haram find purchase.
General Linder looks at Africa through what you call the lens of threat. What does that mean?
That means that he is tasked by General Rodriguez, the head of AFRICOM, in identifying what are, in a military parlance, VEOs, violent extremist organizations. So despite the panoply of lenses one could use to look at Africa and must use to look at Africa to understand the continent, he is exclusively focused, he says myopically focused on threat, because that's what he's tasked to do.
You say that we must abandon traditional nation-on-nation warfare because the terrorists don't pay attention to national borders.
That's right. And the idea of defending borders or training militaries to defend their borders is an outmoded concept.
Are the governments involved in these different countries where the borders are so fluid? Are they welcoming U.S. assistance?
The ones that do welcome U.S. assistance get U.S. assistance, Niger being a prime example. So there are definitely – I mean, you look at where is AFRICOM. AFRICOM is in Germany because of the complications of basing AFRICOM, a U.S. military interest, in Africa itself. So that gets to the point of how complicated it can be to actually go, quote-unquote, help.
Well, the use of drones has become a controversial issue in Pakistan and other countries. What about using drones to track Boko Haram?
Not so controversial. You know, I thought that I would find Africans up in arms about the use of drones in Niger, basing drones, surveillance drones out of Niger in the Sahel. Not once did I come across anybody who was concerned about the use of drones, mostly because we're looking at surveillance drones in most of what I was – the work I was doing, as opposed to armed predator drones.
The United Nations Department of Economic and Social Affairs projects that the African population of 1 billion will almost double by 2100. You mentioned global warming, increasing population. That would suggest that we're going to see more and more militant groups pop up.
That is definitely a possibility and definitely a concern that with dwindling resources and growing populations, this is something I saw in the years of traveling along this belt to report the 10th parallel, that these swelling populations lead to swelling numbers of religious groups on both sides. And it's that primary tension, not about religion per se, but control, power, that leads to the problems.
Most of these groups function like guerrilla groups. And so they seek haven by hiding among refugees and by and villagers. How do you even separate them out?
That's a really – you can't. That's the primary truth. You can't. The only thing you can do is sell your message to the population itself and hope that once that population believes in the military or believes in your method, then they will actually identify the outsiders and say, hey, that guy doesn't come from here. Hey, that guy was preaching this and that. People need to step up and identify the problem within themselves.
Now, there's been a big debate in this country over whether we should be sending troops into Syria, now into Iraq. Do you think that the American public is open to sending more troops to Nigeria or Uganda or the Central African Republic?
I would say on the surface of it, no way. But the truth is the American public believes all different kinds of things, and we have this – the basic question is engagement. How are we to engage abroad? And what resources of our own are we to bring to bear? And what if the military does things better than, say, an aid group is going to do? Do we – you know, it's not 2002. It's 2014. And the sophistications of what we see and what we're able to do are really different now.
I'd imagine that everything will be okay until a number of Americans are killed or captured.
That would be what we've seen before, right? I mean, that would be a replay of 1993 Black Hawk Down that led to American isolationist policies in Africa.
You mentioned President Obama's speech at West Point where he requested $5 billion to build counterterrorism partnerships to, I'm quoting, train, build capacity, and facilitate partner countries in the front lines. What was the reaction of Congress
to that? That's a really good question. Again, I don't think we're seeing a single reaction. And a lot of what President Obama announced is already underway. So these aren't, again, these aren't programs that are necessarily new. They sound new to the American public, but they've been going on. This is what Special Forces has been doing since World War II.
Are we developing strategies to deal with situations like northern Iraq by working in other parts of Africa?
Good question. Now, that's something, can we apply lessons learned in Iraq or Afghanistan to Africa itself? I think that our sensitivity to understanding that local grievances drive local groups, the rise of extremism locally, is profound, and that is a very important lesson.
Do you have an answer to the question you asked in the title of the article, Can General Linder's Special Operations Forces Stop the Next Terrorist Threat?
Well, first of all, I didn't write that question.
This is often a problem with writers, isn't it? I say, what about that headline? And they say, well, I didn't write that headline.
Okay, not only, let's just get clear, not only do reporters for certain magazines not write the headlines and the deck, as it's called, but we don't even see them. So now, do I think that the American Special Operations Forces can seriously address, if not change the course of some of the rise of extremism in Africa? I believe in engagement. And if it takes the U.S. military to do so, I'm talking about being on the ground, looking at building wells, talking to local leaders about what they need, then I'm all for that as part of a larger effort.
You have a multifaceted career. We've been talking about your reporting in Africa, but you've also written poetry and recently edited and translated poetry in a book called I Am the Beggar of the World, Landes from Contemporary Afghanistan, which is published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. What are Landes?
A Lande is a 22-syllable, two-line poem that is uttered anonymously and collectively, primarily by a woman in Afghanistan.
And is this an old tradition?
It's an ancient tradition. The thinking is that they are actually, they're very much pre-Islamic, probably related to Sanskrit, having the same roots as Hinduism.
Since they're anonymous, how did you get them?
I got them by sitting and drinking a hell of a lot of tea in refugee camps in Afghanistan over a two-year period, over a couple of trips, and just listening to women long enough that they were willing to talk about these poems, which belong to Pashtun culture, which is a closed culture.
What kinds of things do they write about?
They write about, or they really sing about, because the Landes are primarily oral, war, grief, sex, drone strikes, the Taliban.
Read one or two for us.
Okay, well, I'll read you. My favorite is, when sisters sit together, they're always praising their brothers. When brothers sit together, they're selling their sisters to others.
So there's a rhyme. Did they rhyme as well, or did you rhyme them in English?
Most of them don't rhyme. Most of them have to end with the sound ma or na. They're very sonorous in Pashto, so they sound like a lullaby, but they bite like a snake, which was one of the words that Landai means.
Well,
you want me to read you another?
One more, but that one was wonderful.
Okay. This is just a fun, you want a really naughty one? Or?
Well, naughty, but not getting me in trouble with the FCC.
Okay, I think this one should be fine. Unlucky you who didn't come last night, I took the hard wooden bedpost for a man.
Eliza Griswold's article, Can General Linder's Special Operation Forces Stop the Next Terrorist Threat, was in the New York Times Magazine, the June 15th issue. And she is also the translator and editor of I Am the Beggar of the World, Landes from Contemporary Afghanistan, just published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. Thank you so much for being on our show again.
Thank you for having me.